The what in the background? The figures in the background?
Yeah, I've never noticed that.
Okay, good. How many of you have noticed the figure in the background before?
I have.
Okay.
I didn't.
So let me see. Peggy, what do those figures suggest to you?
I hadn't noticed them before, but they apparently have their backs turned to the primary figure.
Mm-hmm.
They look like they're a war party, and they're sitting over a fire not noticing what's going on.
Do you see a fire?
In my imagination.
Okay, and do they look warlike to you? Anything about what they're doing that suggests war?
Carrying a spear would make me think that it was a war party.
You're sure that? Okay, could be. Okay. You haven't noticed it before, but I can mention to you that whatever these particular cards, the nice thing about the weight deck is that when something is put in there, it refers to something. So if there's a detail that you've never noticed before, there's a meaning there that you never knew before. It's a clue to you. If you ever see something in a card, and I've been looking at these things for 40 years, and I still see things in cards that I never noticed before. If there's ever anything you come across like that, be aware that it's talking about a meaning about something, and it's worthwhile researching. Okay, so what does the card mean to you in general?
Oh, me?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically what everyone else has said. The person seems to be getting away with something.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting that the tents and his hat all make it appear like it's Mideastern.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to give you the title and the astrology and the numerology of this card and some of the figure meanings. Okay. First of all, the title of the card, which is most often the clue to what the card is, to what the intention of the artist was. Now, the artist, of course, is Pamela Coleman Smith. She's the one who drew these cards, but she did it under the direction of Arthur Waite, and these titles come from him and from the tradition of the Golden Dawn. So, the title of this card is Lord of Unstable Effort. Okay. The reason for that comes primarily from two places. Well, as always, comes primarily from numerology and astrology, and I'll give you the astrology first. The astrology of this card, the astrological attribution of this card, is Moon in Aquarius. If you look at the tents, you see the tent flaps on the right there? You'll notice that there are some wavy lines on some of the tents. Parallel wavy lines, once again, symbols of Aquarius. You'll also see the moon in various forms on those tents. Moon in Aquarius. Okay? There is in Aquarius the quality of gregariousness and of group effort and of general energy and intensity. And if you take a look at two things, the tents, which are a communal thing, and those figures in the background, also a community of sorts. You have a background of Aquarius. You have a background of communal effort and communal energy, and a rather intense energy at that. And the second thing you have is moon. The moon is changeable. The moon, by the light of the moon, nothing is certain. The moon changes phases quickly. Of all the astrological signs, it is the most changeable, the most rapid changing. And what you have with moon in Aquarius is a sense that nothing is certain. Nothing lasts. Nothing can be depended on. You can't tell what's going on. That's what's happening in this card. That's the primary happening in this card, is that you really don't know exactly what's going on. What are those figures in the background doing? What is this guy in the foreground actually doing? He may look happy, but you don't know what the hell he's looking happy about. Is he planting swords or is he taking them away? Can't really tell by looking. The fur trim on his hat and boots, that fur trim refers to the quality of shape-shifting, the ability to become any kind of animal. And it has, again, the quality of the moon, the ability to change its shape and change its light and change its meaning. So this is the Lord of Unstable Effort. Whatever's going on isn't going to last, and you're really not 100% sure of what it's about. So when the sword comes up, that's one of the reasons why the picture seems to evoke from people the sense of sneakiness and getting away with something, maybe stealing, because what happens in all of those things is that nothing is as it seems. A thief doesn't come out and just outright steal from you. It's always done behind the scenes. Somebody who's lying, stealing, cheating, is doing something that isn't the truth. There's the sense that honesty is not happening here. And this is one of the qualities that comes out of Moon in Aquarius. Also, from the numerology point of view, 7. That the 7 is the position on the Tree of Life that deals with instincts and desires, driven by a furnace of life energy. So all of those things, the combination of instability, changeability, uncertainty, plus passion, instinct, and desire, are what are going on in this card. So whenever this card comes up, you're standing, it's like standing on ice floes made of thin ice in the middle of a running river. Really tricky footing. Okay? There are other things to be considered here, but probably we don't have time for a really complete description. So I had asked a couple of people what they felt it meant to them. Peggy, where is the 7 of Swords in your array?
6th position.
Okay. Still in a more or less solid flowing position, comfortable enough. Linda, well, how about you?
This one was the 5.
This was the 5th position?
Yeah.
For you? Okay, who else did I talk to on this one?
Me,
Jean. And Jean, for you?
It was in the 3rd position.
Now, considering what you said about it, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I won't take that any further. Let's take a look at the 8 of Swords. A really interesting card. Anne-Marie, what's the 8 about for you?
Right now I'm looking at it and I'm thinking it's about someone who's cut off from the world, but possibly by their own desire, in order to go into an inward state and come to some type of realization or discovery for themselves.
And where do you get that from?
Well, the person has a blindfold on and you know, like a rope kind of wrapped around her, but it looks to me like she could get out of them. So this is all just a really very personal interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like a feeling kind of to me of just having that she could have personally blocked the world out with these things and put the swords up around her to keep people away from her so that she can go about what she's doing.
Good for you. Where do you have it in your array?
I have it in the 7th position.
Okay, good. Let me see. How about you, Don? What's the 8 about for you?
The 8 for me often is about living in your head rent-free.
That's a good phrase.
It's about, to a certain extent, you're choosing to be where you are, but you're also sort of mired in a certain way of thinking, or you're unable to see beyond your immediate perspective to sort of get the broader picture of what's happening.
Let me ask you a question. If you wanted to, could you tie yourself up like that? Could you tie your hands behind your own back? Could you wrap yourself? Could you do that? Look at that figure.
I hesitate because I think that it would be possible, yes.
Okay. Do you think that's what has happened here? You think this person has gone through the contortions necessary to do that? Is that the sense you get?
No. It isn't.
Okay. Then in that case, how does that affect, or would it affect, what you just said? If somebody else did it, how much of what you say or just said would stand?
Huh. Well, not all of it.
Some of it, maybe. Which part?
Well, I think the part as far as the person choosing to stay there.
Uh-huh.
They may not be thinking the way that they are necessarily through their own effort or through something that they began.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else may have been directing sort of their mental shift. But once they're there, to a large extent, it's their choice to remain there, in part because they may not know or see that there are other options available to them. though, because the key thing for me in this card is, I mean, the woman is bound and she's blindfolded, but she's still relatively free. She's not completely surrounded by the swords, and her legs aren't bound. She's still capable of movement and of sort of moving out of the ring, and possibly even freeing herself.
Is she standing on the ground? Look.
Yes, she is.
Okay. Let me see.
Walt?
Yeah?
Could I just say something about where she's standing? Because I was noticing this just before you asked whether she's standing on the ground. To me, it's like she has one foot in the water and one foot on the ground.
Okay.
So one thing that that could mean to me is kind of dipping into the unconscious in one part and also holding on to something solid with another part.
Good observation. Peggy, what's your sense of this? Is she standing on the ground, on the water, part in each, in the air? What's she doing?
Part in each, like almost like the star card or the temperance card.
Okay, so if you look at this, if you look at the ground, the actual foreground that she seems to be standing on, part water, part land, and it's your impression that she is standing partly on one surface and partly on another, what would be your reason for saying, I mean, why? What do you think that means, if that's the way you feel about it? Is there a significance to that?
What it would mean to me is that she has been bound by her own thoughts, and now she's beginning to balance her emotions with reality, to perhaps move out of it.
Okay. So you would guess then that the mixture, the kind of interesting mixture of land and water, where there's no clear boundary between the two, is significant, that it was intentional, that the artist had something in mind with that. Okay, that's mainly what I wanted to know. And then, if you were going to give me your... Oh, before I go, I should ask Don, where is the Eight of Swords in your array?
It's in the fifth position.
Seventh?
Five.
Oh, five. Okay, fifth position. Good. And Peggy, where is the Eight of Swords in your array?
Third.
That's interesting. Which means, of course, that for some reason or other, the Eight of Swords finds favor with you. Why is that?
More favor than some of the other cards.
why so?
Because there is, at least it appears to me like there's movement involved, that there is a progression.
Well, there's...
That there is some change, and it seems to be, given an optimistic point of view to me, it seems to be that it would be positive, because she seems to be moving away from the swords.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you think she's moving away from the swords, not toward them?
Yes.
Okay. And so for you, there is a sense that she's leaving some kind of obstacle or difficulty behind.
Correct.
Okay, even though there's uncertainty underfoot and a certain amount of congestion above, still things are looking more or less optimistic or something like that. Okay.
There's slow movement. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, did you actually, were you ever taught these interpretations from anyone?
No.
Okay. Do you have any book knowledge about this card?
I guess if I said HOD, which makes me... Am I pronouncing that right?
Well, HOD, why do you say HOD?
The eight.
Okay. So, yeah, that's the reference, but do you have any idea what that would mean in connection with this card?
Not necessarily in connection. HOD is thoughts, it's Mercury.
Well, but that's, you could say that about all the swords.
Yeah.
Okay, good. We'll come to that in a minute. So let me see here. Let me give you some of the knowledge references to this. First, let me give you the title. The title, the esoteric title of this card, is the Lord of Shortened Force. If I were you, by the way, I would write this stuff down. Not that it isn't in every book. You can find these titles everywhere. But it's good that you have it here in connection with what we're doing, because it will probably mean more to you, since it isn't just a set of words. I'm explaining the references to it, and you might find it useful to have the references together here. The Lord of Shortened Force. And it comes primarily from the astrological attribution, which is Jupiter in Gemini. Now, Jupiter happens to be in its detriment in Gemini, which means that things are difficult and tricky, not as expansive and happy as usual. Okay? Tricky business. It's called the Lord of Shortened Force, partly because the eights, which are connected with HUD, the meaning of eight here, is essentially something that is successful or meaningful or appropriate for a short time or for the moment. It doesn't have a long-term effect. It isn't it isn't going to stay this way for long. It's good as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far, which is why shorten the force. That's what the eights in general mean, and the eights, you can find that in general throughout the four eights of the deck. But in this particular case, it's the Lord of Shortened Force because of Jupiter, which is forceful, and it's shortened because it's eight, and it is shown the way it is because of the following. There, remember I mentioned to you that part of the meaning of the cards, a good chunk of the meaning of the cards, comes from iconography, from the symbolic or sacred pictures that come from a variety of traditions. A good chunk of those are esoteric, secret order stuff. And what you're looking at here, a secret order picture. You're looking at a diagram or a description, in a very brief, truncated sort of way, of an initiatory ceremony. What happens in an initiation is that as a person goes from stage to stage of knowledge, they go through rites of initiation which allow them to use the knowledge that they've gained in secret order work and go on to the next stage. And when a person is brought into a temple, an esoteric temple, and is going to go through an initiation process, they are bound, usually three times around the waist, and they are hoodwinked, either with a bag or a blindfold, indicating that a person is coming in bound by their previous ignorance and their previous sad state. And in due course, as the initiation progresses, the blindfold will be stripped away, and the bonds around the arms will also be removed, and the person will be brought to light and freedom. There are a series of officers in every temple. The number of officers pictured here are eight, and they're indicated by the swords. Those are meant to be the officers in the lodge that are accompanying this person into and through the rite of initiation. The reason that there is an opening between the swords, three on one side and five on the other, is because there is an entrance into the lodge. There's an entrance into the temple, and she has been brought in. So she is right now just at the process where she is about to be initiated. So her blinds, her blindfold and her bonds are not going to be on her for very long. They're more ritual than real, but they represent a real situation of prior ignorance. You notice the castle in the background. That's the old way of life. That's the old standard, the old bastion of whatever she thought, however she was, whatever her stage of things was. That's the way it used to be. She'll never go back there again. So you're looking at, on one hand, a simple example of things not going well, being stuck, blindfolded, ignorant, temporarily frustrated, all those things. And depending on the situation that a person is in, if a person comes to you for a reading, all of those things are true, and the things that you said in terms of your own intuitive sense of what the card is about are all true, but that's why they're true. This is an initiation process. So what is about to happen is a freedom and elevation that wasn't possible before. So however bad things are at the moment, they're about to get better, and so, Peggy, you are absolutely correct. And each of you was correct. You actually, each one had a very, very good instinctive feeling about what this card was about, based entirely on what you could see there, because none of you seemed to have any prior teaching about this. So you were just getting it from the picture. And that's why I said that these pictures are evocative. They're meant to evoke from each person who looks at them a certain range of truth. So almost everybody will get something true out of looking at the cards without knowing anything. But it's kind of nice to know where it comes from. Okay, let me see. So now, where are we here? Okay, we're about to do the nine. Nine is an interesting card. Let me see, Scheherazade, what's the nine about for you?
For me, it's a lot of mental anguish and depression and worrying about things that may not need to be worried about. They're created in the mind. I think with the blanket covering the person and it having the roses, and I think of that as desire, and then the astrological signs, it's like the whole world is covering the person, so there's a lot of potential, but this person is so wrapped up in trying to analyze problems and having sleeplessness because of it that they can't see the light.
Great. Absolutely. And again, do you have a basis in either book knowledge or teacher learning to say those things from?
Well, the knowledge of what a rose means and the astrological symbols and the sort of...
What does a rose mean?
Well, to me, the rose is desire.
Mm-hmm.
And the red rose is, you know, passionate desire or desire that can be realized.
Mm-hmm.
And made reality.
Okay, so those are things that come to you from I'm not exactly sure where, but it's not specifically tarot-related book learning.
No.
Okay. And where is it in your array?
It was 10th.
Mine too. That's so funny. How many people here have the Nine of Swords towards the back of their array?
Me.
I did.
Uh-huh. Does anybody have the Nine of Swords close to the front of their array? Nary a soul. That's so funny. Okay. Me too. There's something about that card that turns everybody off pretty much. Okay. Does anybody have the Nine of Swords in the middle of their array? Ha. Huh. Okay. Well, that says something. There's a pretty common acceptance of that. Okay. Let me see. Jaina, what's your sense of the Nine of Swords? What's it about?
Well, it's about very active mental stuff, a lot of doubt, and questioning choices that you've made, things that you've done, and not actually looking at the many blessings that you have in your life.
Why do you say what you say?
That's a good question.
Where does that come from?
I'm sure to some degree it comes from things that I've read, but I can't pinpoint the exact reference.
Usually, when something is only vaguely remembered, you have to kind of stumble through it. God, I'm not sure. What was that thing I read? I don't know. Just something about, but what you just said was very fluent. It came readily to the tongue. How come?
I guess because I have a friend who this card comes up quite a bit for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've given this card probably more thought than some of the other cards.
Okay, so it's basically then come from a combination of experience and familiarity. You've just dealt with it a lot. Good, okay. Let me see. Kelly, what's the Nine of Swords about for you?
I don't have anything new to add, but I have a question.
Uh-huh.
What is the relief underneath?
There is actually a picture. I wish I had my magnifying glass. I have to remember this because I can't really see it clearly. But then what you're basically looking at is an attack. You're looking at a male attacking a female. It's an outrage of some sort. It's either a rape or something. I can't remember exactly. I have a reference to that, a symbolic reference to that somewhere, but I don't remember exactly what it is. Well, basically, what you're doing is looking at violence. I mean, you're looking just a plain old-fashioned scene of violence, and I don't remember specifically what it refers to.
Is that any way connected with the rose, because the rose is beautiful, but yet it has thorns? And so?
Well, in a way, yes, in a way, no. But I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
I'll get to that in a minute.
The only other thing that I might add to that is sometimes when I see this card, I think, duh. You know?
You think what?
Kind of like hitting on your head, duh. What's going on? Might it nice, you know, that kind of thing.
That's interesting. Okay, good. Anybody else have any feelings about this card that we haven't mentioned before?
Okay. One thing that I read that actually fits in with the statement you made in the last class, I think, Wald, is that in this card, I know when it comes up in readings, it's often helpful for me to remember that only one of these swords in the card is real. The others tend to be mental projections.
Well, actually, yeah, there's always, this is what the Nine of Swords is the sword seen from the viewpoint, from the perspective of the number nine. So the nine swords, all they do is give you a visual clue that you're talking about nine. That's how they show it, that it's a nine, mostly is to show nine swords, but there's really only one sword there.
Right. So in sort of keeping in that, I tend to interpret it as someone tending to think of things as being worse than they actually are,
mm-hmm.
or possibly even unnecessarily worrying.
Okay, that's actually a good point. Now, if I understand right, Ruth Ann has a particularly fond connection, or not so fond connection, with
yeah.
this card, and there's some interesting stuff that she came across that some of you might relate to, and it's very interesting.
I know Gene wanted to say something.
Oh, I'm sorry,
let him
Gene.
Say
yes.
Oh,
you know, I noticed on the quilt
the astrological signs
mm-hmm.
in the green, and also the you mentioned the violence. The figure seems to be moving away from the violence, and the swords, to me, the way they're arrayed, seem to be, you know, almost steps up out of that.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. You got it. It's a ladder up and out. You're right about that. Good for you. But again, do you have any reason for saying that other than the suggestiveness of the image itself?
No, because I'm looking at the swords, and they look like a staircase going up.
That's exactly right. Good for you. Ruth Ann, tell us about this little thing, because it's so interesting.
Yeah, well, this comes from a yogic tradition. I live with the Nine of Swords. Being a hermit, the Nine is... All the Nines tend to have power for me, but the Nine of Swords seems to be one of those, like, you know, ruling cards of my life, unfortunately. And one of the things that I learned somewhere along the line, which helped me cope with this and see it in a totally different way, and a couple of you may recognize this phrase, it's the Matrika Shakti. And I'm going to let Wald explain a little bit what's Matrika Shakti. Are you familiar with that, Donna Marcy?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Okay. Can you see this card in that context?
Yeah, actually.
Okay.
Okay, well, let me put it to you this way. There is a yogic saying that says, if you want to achieve liberation, don't let the letters come together. What basically happens is that that the world, so they say, is made up of the combinations of letters. And this is actually a Kabbalistic tradition as well. The entire universe comes into being as the potential contained in the letters of sacred alphabets find their way together and make words and meanings. And you are caught and captured in the net of words and meanings and concepts. And then after those are in place, you can never get through them again. And this word, this network of words and meanings and all the letters that come together and the power of the word and in all its aspects is called Matrika Shakti. Shakti, generally speaking, refers to the great creative, the great feminine creative energy from which everything is made. And Matrika has to do with this power of the word. So it's the great creative energy, great creative power contained in the word.
Could you spell that, please?
Matrika is M-A-T-R-I-K-A. And Shakti is S-H-A-K-T-I.
Does the word Trika have any linguistic connection with matrix?
It might very well, actually. One of the interesting things that I found about Sanskrit, and I know very little about it, but I know just enough about it to know that the clear, obvious root of many English words comes directly from Sanskrit. So it's a good point. I never thought of that, but you're actually right. Could well be.
The thing about the Matrika Shakti specifically is that oftentimes we'll have emotional responses to word phrases. So let's say a phrase...
Hold on a second.
Just live in a very busy area. Anyway, let's say you have a phrase comes into your head, I'm in a good mood, or I'm having a good day. Somehow, there's a lot of emotions that follow that. But if the phrase comes into your head, I really don't feel well, or I'm depressed, or I'm worthless, a lot of other things, you know, again, follow in that direction. But what happened was, it's the phrase, and in my experience, a lot of times, just like these phrases will pop into my head, and they're just a series of words, and they don't necessarily have any basis in reality and what's going on. It's just all of a sudden this phrase appears, and the trick is to recognize when that happens and say, oh, okay, that's the Matrika Shakti, that's a phrase, that those are a bunch of words, and they can sort of like, you can dissipate them.
Yeah, that's how there's a whole tradition connected with Matrika Shakti, and that's like, we can't really get into that, but it's
right.
An interesting point.
I mean, it's a really interesting exercise to try sometime, and it's really a practice, and you know, and I work with it a lot. I'm not always successful, but when a lot of times now I'll see the Nine of Swords in terms of that and saying, okay. And a number of you have said things similar with, you know, the stuff is in your head. And this is one way of looking at that, is just saying, well, what, how real is it, or is it just words?
It's also the way we talk to ourselves. I mean, I've heard people say, my back is killing me,
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the worst terminology used for simple ailments.
Words are extremely magical powers. And that's why the formulas made out of words make so much magic. And one of the magical things you do to yourself is if you're constantly referring to things like a pain in the ass or a pain in the neck or I could kill that person or something along those lines, the tendency is for those things to have some, they manifest.
Right.
And so you got to be careful of what you say. Well, anyway, the Matrika Shakti and the Nine of Swords is very strong, but let me give you the astrological and numerological aspects of this thing from which this picture comes. First of all, the title, the esoteric title of this card is the Lord of Despair and Cruelty. And it comes from two places. It comes again from the astrology and from the numerology. The astrology of this card, the astrological attribution of this card, is Mars and Gemini. The extremely hot, cruel, ravaging energy of Mars entering into a place of duality and splits and differences and imbalances. And what it does, it has a tendency to split a person into bits and pieces, to shatter them, to crack them, and to inject into it an extremely hot and an intense energy. So that what you have is a person who is buried in their own head. I think as Don pointed out, you know, we have a person who is living rent-free in their own head. And it's, and only the actual thing here is it's not rent-free because you are working your tail off inside that little skull of yours. And it's hot and nasty and painful in there. So that's one of the things that's going on. The second thing comes from the Nine. Nine of Swords is a combination of air and air, the element of air in the suit of swords, and the element of air in the number nine. The number nine, the ninth position on the Tree of Life, is called Yesod, foundation. And it's connected with the element of air. It's also the astral plane, the location of the astral plane on the Tree of Life. And what you've got here is a person whose mind is floating in the astral plane with the energy of Mars. What a rotten combination.
Okay, that's why it's so bad.
So yeah, you've got ghosts and demons and images and dreams and nightmares and, I mean, all sorts of things which are given the energy of Mars, which is like giving a red-hot poker to a demon inside your head.
So that's why all of it seems exaggerated on that ninth position.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Now,
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And so the despair, of course, comes from the fact that you can't get out of your head. It's a hopeless entanglement. And the cruelty comes from the intense red-hot poker quality of the energy of Mars that's injected into this. Now, as far as the elements themselves are concerned that are in the card, the rose that you mentioned on the cover is actually a Rosicrucian rose. It's the rose of the Rosicrucian, and which gives a certain spirituality to the covering, and the zodiac signs that alternate with it on the cover, together with the darkness of what looks like a night sky, combine to give you again the aspect of air, which is the element of swords. And also the proper element of Yesod, the number nine and air combined. And it gives you, again, it gives you the entire spectrum in that coverlet. It gives you the entire spectrum of things to worry about. literally everything under the sun. Another interesting thing about that figure as it wakes up is it shows itself, and Gene had pointed out that it looked like a ladder. And when you wake up from your dream, you go, of course, why didn't I see that before? Because basically it's all in your head. And you can see a way up and out once you wake up. And there's a sense of, oh my God, of course. So there's a certain possibility of liberation, although it may only last for a fraction of a second. And the same mind that imprisons you allows you escape by way of that ladder. But it's really a tough place to be in. The Nine of Swords is a combination of really tricky elements. Okay, we're just about coming to the end, so let's do the Ten. I mean, there's a lot more to be said about that, but we already know the Nine of Swords is a universally not particularly liked card. It doesn't show up very high in anybody's array. Let's take a look at the Ten of Swords. Let me see. Well, first of all, let me ask you, does anybody have the Ten of Swords among the first five cards of their array?
This is Gina, I do.
Okay, where is it in your array?
Three.
Okay, what's your sense of what the Ten of Swords is about?
The Ten of Swords is a place, my keyword for ten, or key phrase, is to reflect and visualize. So
okay.
It's kind of like, you know, when you're breathing and that space or just that split second in between your breath?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I think of the Ten of Swords.
That's interesting. Good for you. Actually, there's a reason for that, and we'll come back. If I don't mention it again, if I don't say, Jane, I'm going to talk about what you just said, remind me, because there's a really important point in there. Good. And there's something about that that you don't see it. You don't see it as a murdered figure?
No, I really don't. I see it kind of the end of one cycle moving into the other, but the background tells me that, you know, new opportunities and stuff. So I don't focus as much on the murdered figure.
Good for you. Good for you. Okay, that point we'll come back to. So let me see. Who hasn't talked in a long time here? How about Scheherazade? What's the ten mean to you?
Okay, I see the ten as definitely a point of realization of something intellectually and a time for transformation. So there needs to be a death and then a rebirth.
Why does there need to be a death? Why does there need to be a death if you just realize something?
Because once there's a realization, it necessitates change, and in order to change, you need to let go of something. So
in other words, once you realize something, whatever you realize means that something's finished.
Right.
Whatever you just realized means that whatever you thought before is gone.
Right.
So there's, yeah, okay, that's good.
Yeah.
And where do you have it in your array?
I had it seventh.
Okay, good. And let me see, Kelly, what's the ten about for you?
The only new thing I'd have would be, I always think it's too much, you know?
Too much of what?
It could kill you.
It could kill you, right, okay.
You know, it doesn't. It would be overkill.
Mm-hmm. Overkill is actually one of the standard interpretations of this card, by the way.
Or martyrdom, too,
mm-hmm.
Because there's
Did anybody ever see Murder on the Orient Express?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I always think about that when I look at this card. But anyway, Linda, what's your sense of the ten?
Pretty much the same as what everyone else is saying, but just kind of an exaggerated interpretation of pain. Kind of
exaggerated in what way? What's exaggerated?
Well, I mean, kind of like what you had said last class about how there was really only one sword.
Mm-hmm.
But it shows so many, and it probably only takes one sword to kill somebody.
Okay, so there's a certain amount of overkill in there, in your understanding of this too. And just really, when you stab somebody 10 times, you kill them with 10. It's not even as bad as stabbing somebody. I mean, it's worse than stabbing somebody 10 times. By the way, did you notice there's no blood?
Yeah.
Or at least not coming out of his back, anyway. Kind of an interesting thought. No, has anybody noticed that there are no footsteps in the sand?
At least not the side we can see.
Not the side you can see, no. His clothes, if it's a him, don't seem disarrayed either. He looks kind of peaceful. How can it be? How could it be that somebody could be stabbed like that with 10 swords going down the spine in such a way that it looks more like acupuncture than murder?
To me, it looks like there is a little blood on mine at the throat.
There is actually the blood leaving the mouth underneath the head. Yeah, right, absolutely. But from the back, there isn't. Where the storage actually goes
right.
In, there doesn't seem to be any mess or fuss at all. Interesting point.
And couldn't be that from the throat have something to do with communication?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Could well be. Linda, where was the Ten of Swords in your array?
It's
10th. 10th, okay. Well, that means you're not ready to leave here yet. I would guess death and overkill are not for you. Are you by the way, does that suggest in any way that exaggeration and overdoing is not your cup of tea?
I mean, I'm sure I suffer from it just different times. you know, fixating on things. So I'm by no means free of that.
I don't mean that you're free of it, but that you don't like it much, whether you find it in yourself or someone else.
I guess that's a fair statement. I mean...
Okay, I didn't want to push it too hard. It just struck me as an interesting
like
possibility.
Dwelling.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me give you the astrological and numerological interpretations of this thing and where that comes from. The title, the esoteric title of this card, is the Lord of Ruin. Things are totally messed up. By the way, look at the background. You see the dark sky and the yellow,
mm-hmm.
the gray, sort of a gray, yellow, black combination. Would you say offhand, let me see, who thinks that there is a certain clearing of the sky?
I do.
Who thinks that it's night coming down? Okay, that's an interesting thing to notice. There is a certain amount of optimism I see in this group, or at least a wish fulfillment anyway.
This is
the
swords are bright.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. There is, in a number of places, I've seen books where they'll say something like, it's darkest before the dawn, and you know, that kind of thing. Well, I want you to know, guys, the official interpretation of that is that it is in this card, you're looking at the loss of consciousness. This is the Sun in Gemini. Okay? The darkness is falling, not the sun rising. Sometimes people think, well, you don't really know. You look at the card, and from the picture, you can't really tell, and you're sort of free to make up your own mind about which way it is. And, of course, in particular situations, if you're working with a particular querent, and the question is of a certain kind, and the energy is a certain way, if you want to, it might be appropriate to say, well, the dawn is coming. But the official meaning of this card, the real stuff here, is that darkness is about to descend. Darkness is in the process of descending. Pretty soon, it's going to be dark out there. It's going downhill. It's not going up. It's all the way down. The Lord of Ruin. Sun in Gemini. Now, 10. I think it was Jaina who was talking about 10s as the completion of a cycle and the beginning of another one. Now, you may or may not realize, I think we mentioned it before, that each one of the suits, swords included, represents a world, a Kabbalistic world. There are four of them, and there's one for each suit, one for each element. This is the end of the world of air. 10 is the last card in the world of air. It's the bottom of the tree of life in the world of air. But the 10th card, the 10th position in one world, becomes the first position in the next world. And the world that comes right after swords is pentacles. So oddly enough, the end of the line in swords is the beginning of the line in pentacles. So it's something to be considered. It's not exactly, you can't say that it's you know, about to be a rebirth. If it is, it's a rebirth that this character would never recognize. It's a rebirth into an entirely different universe. That person who's lying there, that idea, that subject, that issue that's lying there on that beach with its sword stuck in him will never rise again. And as I'm so fond of saying, because I love the phrase from Star Trek, it's dead, Jim.
I just realized something. If you consider that pentacles is the body, and that the next step would be a new body, you could look at this card as a card of reincarnation.
That's right. You could. But, you know, when you reincarnate, you remember nothing of what
was
before.
Well, I know.
Not only that, but reincarnation usually seems to imply a coming back into the same world you left, maybe as a different, you know, organism,
no.
or as a, you know, different memory, but, you know, you were in this world, you're coming back to this world, and, you know, you're a different person in it. But what you're looking at here is not reincarnation on the same level, it's going down a level, stepping down, not up, or not sideways either. The
so
10 is...
You wouldn't see it as a transformation, then?
Well, it's a transformation only if you consider that when something dies, it's dead, and when it's dead, it's certainly different than it used to be.
Yeah, actually, I love what Isabel Radow-Kligman says about this card in her book, Tarot and the Tree of Life.
Uh-huh.
She says, you want to know the good news about the Ten of Swords? There's no 11 of swords.
There you go.
Rock bottom. This is as bad as it's going to get.
That's right. It's as bad as it's going to get because that's all there is, that's all she wrote. And that's really true. One of the nice things, one of the things that I find that I find useful in the Ten of Swords, especially since so many readings are about relationships. When the Ten of Swords comes up, it usually means that a relationship is over, or that something you're dealing with in a relationship is finished. And when you want a relationship, when you're going through a divorce or you're a messy, you know, arrangement with somebody, the Ten of Swords is a great relief. Oh my God, thank God it's over. So it's a very happy card under those circumstances. Or if you want to know, for example, if somebody has left you, or if the querent, you know, has asks you about, you know, somebody has left me, are they coming back? And the Ten of Swords comes up, you can comfortably say no. He ain't coming back. It's over, kid. Time to move on. You can forget this one. So, you know, now that can be a good thing. There's nothing to hang on to here. There's no continuation. As you just said, there's no 11.
But what I find is interesting is that the beach on this one does appear to be earth or sand.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 5 and in the 2, the beach appeared not to be a beach, but almost a solid gray.
Right. Well, that's because those two. Well, in the two, you're looking at what is called a stage card, and that has a whole separate implication of things. So we have to kind of deal with that. In the five, actually, that's also true. Both of those are stage cards, which means the ground is not really so much a natural habitat as a stage on which something is being acted out. Here,
okay.
Something is really happening. You'll find that many of the cards throughout the Minor Arcana are given that stage quality. And whenever you see a stage card, which is a flat foreground separated from the background by a carefully ruled line, that what you're looking at is the possibility